you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories. Today, I'd like to introduce our new writer, Kevin Valbonesi. Kevin is an experienced podcaster who runs a company called Baroque Media. He wrote, voiced, and produced the show you're about to hear today. I'd like to thank our members for making this show possible, and in gratitude, I have a very special show available for you. You can hear a sample of it at the end of this show. This is Rex Morris by Kevin Valbonesi. Enjoy.
Oh, hello. I'm Dr. Alexius, and you must be the new agent. It's nice to have a fresh face around here. Enthusiasm for the classical Roman Empire is in decline. Sorry, I can't help myself. Anyway, you can imagine that if people have had their fill of Trajan or Caesar Augustus, they're probably not too keen on the 11 or so Constantines. And that's why you're here. Your paper on Norman conquests in the Mediterranean was a wonderful read. You were able to make that particular era leap off the page. That's what we need here. We need people to get excited about the more obscure chapters of history. If we can do that, we can get tours back up and running. Now, I should tell you that you won't be going back to the 11th century you know so well. I've discovered a timeline that diverges from our own in the late 1030s, and I think it's just what our clientele are looking for. In this timeline, the Eastern Roman Empire, was attempting a reconquest of Sicily from the Arabs. They sent a rather cosmopolitan force of Romans, Varangians, Normans, and Lombards to do the job. They made great headway, smashing the various emirates on the island. Regrettably, a personal feud within the Byzantine ranks led to the murder of their general and the flight of the Lombard and Norman forces back to mainland Italy. Not wanting to lose everything it had gained, the court at Constantinople appointed the commander of the Varangians, one Harald Sigurdsson, to see the conquest of the island through to its conclusion. Harald didn't disappoint. However, after capturing the island, Harald reorganized it as his own personal fief, much to the consternation of Constantinople. Please put on your costume now, while I finish your orientation. You will visit Harald's court in the year 1066, an auspicious year in our timeline, and in this one. You'll be going undercover as a courtier from Constantinople. Harald's ambitions in this timeline reach far beyond the shores of Sicily. He swept the sea like Pompey before him and made Sicily the crown jewel in a Mediterranean thalassocracy. Several islands, and even some coastal cities all around the basin, have come under Harald's personal dominion. This Sicilian success hasn't been universally welcomed, I assure you. The courts of Cairo, Rome, Granada, and even Constantinople are all alarmed by Harald's aggressive approach. Still, there is something to be said for that Viking spirit. All right, let's have a look at you. Ah, you wear that robe well. It's real Byzantine silk, you know. How very romantic. Sorry, really couldn't help that one. Anyway, step onto the platform over here, take a deep breath, relax, and enjoy the ride. Your eyes sting, burned by sun in the salty air. You raise a hand to your face and squint, trying to draw detail from the blinding scene in front of you. Surf sprays your feet, the water getting in between your toes. You look down and can just about make out your sandaled feet and the wooden planks beneath them. As your sight returns to normal, you discover that you are standing at the edge of a pier, looking out over a massive harbor. Two arcs of land reach out, pulling the waters of the bay into their earthy embrace, leaving a broad enough opening for ships to pass through. A light breeze tickles you and fills your nostrils with the perfume of the sea. Someone shoves you aside, almost launching you into the water. You regain your balance and turn around to scold the fool. You see that there's a ship behind you, and sailors who are all staring at you, somewhat confused. And they're all bearded fellows, with sun-kissed skin and bright white tunics. One man shakes his fist at you, nearly dropping the crate in his arms. Your translator kicks into gear, turning the foreign sounds into something more familiar, confirming that, yeah, these are sailors. You turn and walk down the pier, reaching the harbor proper. You look around, trying to find your bearings. The harbor looks even larger from here, and you're suddenly aware of all the other ships making port. Most of the ships are galleys, long and with massive sails. There are a few smaller barks, and at the far end of the harbor, a massive ship occupying a large and well-protected dock. A hand grasps your shoulder, startling you. You spin, expecting to scold one of the sailors, but you're surprised to find a refined-looking man standing there. This man looks Middle Eastern, perhaps an Arab or a Berber. He wears a flowing blue robe with Arabic calligraphy sewn into it. His long, curly hair droops down around his face, contrasting with his well-maintained beard.
I am Mustafa ibn al-Rashid. Nice to finally put a face to such illustrious letters.
You take Mustafa's hand and shake it, prompting a confused look on his part. You blush and try to grin your way through the anachronism.
Letters? Oh, yes, forgive me. I write many letters to many people. It's so nice to finally meet you, Mustafa.
Your trip from the capital was a pleasant one, I hope.
Fine, a bit bumpy, but yes, fine.
Listen, Mustafa, I'm feeling a bit out of sorts. Perhaps I'm still finding my legs.
Mustafa places a reassuring hand on your shoulder.
Or perhaps you've been cooking under the sun too long. Either way, let's get you to the palace. Unfortunately, if you'd arrived a little earlier, we could have relaxed. But alas, there is an exciting afternoon at court that I must attend to.
Your ears perk up at the mention of a palace. The palace, you say?
Oh dear, we'd better hurry then. Yes, the palace at Syracuse.
Right, yes. Forgive me, Mustafa.
Not a problem, my friend. We'll get you some water on the way.
Mustafa gestures for you to follow him, and you do. As the two of you take leave of the place, you notice a particular ship docking at one of the many piers. This particular galley looks built for capacity rather than combat. Several men in wool cloaks and strange caps stand at the bow of the ship, looking less than enthused. You catch a glimpse of the winged beast emblazoned on their sail, just as they roll it up. You take note of it, and continue on your way.
Syracuse looks like what you'd expect of an 11th century city. Small wooden and brick homes press up against each other, dominating the area closest to the harbor. Meanwhile, the remnants of the old Greco-Roman city dominate the interior. The population of Syracuse is remarkably cosmopolitan. The former masters of the island, the Arabs, are plentiful, but they are roughly matched in number by the Byzantine Romans. You can't help but smile as a group of Roman and Arab boys run past you and Mustafa, clearly in the middle of a serious game of tag. You even spy a few Latin Christians, dressed in slightly more severe garments,
and with closely cropped hair and beards. You surmise that they're probably Lombards or citizens of Italy's many maritime republics. You find yourself concerned by the number of armed men walking about. In particular, several heavily armored giants who lead mixed regiments of Roman and Arab infantrymen. You can barely make out anything about these titans, save that they're Europeans, and that most sport red or blonde beards. You ponder on the men for a moment, and turn to Mustafa to confirm your suspicions. Those huge men walking around in all that armor, are they Varangians?
Yes, you must recognize them from the capital. Are you surprised to see them here?
Well, not exactly, no. I just figured they'd be at the palace.
There are only so many nooks and crannies to guard, and too many men to staff them. So, we let them march around, keep themselves occupied with the other men. But more of them arrive every day from the north, looking for fame and fortune in Harald's ranks.
Idle hands, I suppose. But what about the Muslims? The conquest must still be fresh in everyone's mind.
Necessity makes strange bedfellows, my friend. When Harald defeated the Emirates that once ruled here, he realized that he did not have sufficient force to expel all of the Muslims on the island. The deal was struck. Every Muslim was free to stay and practice their faith, so long as they paid taxes and their young men served in the army for a period of 5 years.
Did you take that deal?
Me? No. I'm from Ifriqiya. I got on a boat when I heard that Harald was recruiting mercenaries. I expected to serve a few years and return home with my wealth, but Harald took notice of me and made me an offer I couldn't refuse. Which was, the king heard that I was better on the sea than I was on the land. Fair enough, my father was a fisherman. I knew my way around the boat and got pretty good at building them. So, Harald asked me to stay on and supervise the construction of a new fleet.
You turn back to the now distant harbor, pondering the multitude of ships. Mustafa doesn't give you much time to think, gesturing ahead once more. Why all the ships, then?
Sicily is surrounded on all sides by water. Any prince who wishes to threaten our island home must do so by ship. Harald understood that. His people are great raiders, and so long as no ship opposed them, they plundered with impunity. He would not allow the same to happen here.
So you built a fleet to protect yourselves?
More than protect. Harald is not just prudent, he is ambitious. We cleared the immediate waters of pirates and hostile princes, but then we looked further. We realized that Sicily could control commerce from either end of the sea. We seized many port cities and pillaged whatever we could not hold. Most of the great harbors, from Syria to Spain, belong to us now, and any foreign ship which crosses the sea must pay for that privilege.
I don't imagine that made you very popular.
The spoils in the adventure helped to keep the men in line, so we're in no position to stop. And anyway, I do believe the island is better off for it all.
You reach a bustling market with all the wonders of the Mediterranean on display. Merchants peddle trinkets made of gold, ivory, obsidian, and lapis lazuli. In the stalls opposite them, fishermen heave their daily catches into baskets. There are bowls full of grains and nuts all around, outnumbered by many amphorae, likely filled with wine and olive oil. There are even men hauling large planks of cedar up and down the street. Wool, cotton, and silk are all measured out, rolled, and sold. And yes, there is a slave market as well, where cruel men line up their human products before well-dressed patricians and their entourages.
We have made this rocky little island the envy of all princes, perhaps even the capital itself.
That's all well and good, but I doubt this policy is making many friends. I know for one that the queen of all cities is a paranoid woman indeed.
If you really want to know what everyone thinks, let us double our pace. The show will begin shortly.
Show?
You'll see.
the Palace of Syracuse isn't what you'd expect of a medieval seat of power. It's more like a Roman basilica, replete with massive columns, domed ceiling, and arches galore. What strikes you the most, however, is how the island's shared heritage is on display. Byzantine mosaics line the walls, threatening to blind all onlookers with their scenes swimming in golden tesserae. These mosaics feature scenes of Harold's conquest of Sicily, making him look conspicuously like an emperor in his regalia. The main corridor of the palace is supported by a series of horseshoe arches, all decorated with Arabic calligraphy. You also notice that between each arch, on either side, are niches carved out in Arabic honeycomb fashion, each home to a marble sculpture, mostly old and damaged Greek sculptures of the Hellenistic period. You reach the main chamber, modeled after the Roman Senate, replete with half-ring seating, all facing around a central stage. A large marble seat, covered in red cushions and ornate textiles, commands the room. You can make out a few runes chiseled into the back wall. Your translator activates, immediately satisfying your curiosity. The runes read, King of the Seas. Mustafa leads you up a marble staircase. You take your seats at the back row and watch as other men enter the chamber and take their places. Again, a good cross-section of the medieval world is present. Well-to-do Romans mill about, carrying themselves like the senators of old. Arab merchants and army officers chat amongst themselves, occasionally turning to their neighbors and uttering a few words in Greek. Meanwhile, the few Latin Christians in the room, mostly men of the cloth, sit in uncomfortable silence, paying little to no heed of their colleagues. Finally, you take notice of the only men in the room with weapons. Several Varangians patrol around, keeping their axes down at their sides. Even in here, they keep their armor on. A few of them even wear chainmail masks. An attendant enters the room and takes his position to the right of the throne.
Noble gentlemen of Sicily, and our most honored guests, thank you for joining us today. I ask that you rise and welcome your host.
Everyone gets to their feet. Two rows of Varangians enter the chamber, flanking a man who somehow manages to stand a head above even these giants. Once you see the flowing red cloak, dazzling blue tunic, and long silver hair, you know it can be no other man than Harald Sigurdsson. Harald takes his place on the throne.
I give you Harald Sigurdsson, King of Sicily, Dukes of Corfu, Count of Malta, Prince of Majorca, Judge of Sardinia, Lord of Africa, and most humble servant of the Emperor Constantine.
Harald gestures for everyone to take a seat. He rises.
Let's start with whoever has the biggest problem. I will address your concerns here and now, and then you can head home. Deal?
There is a disturbance outside of the hall. A large group of well-dressed men march into the room, dressed in the height of medieval finery, if a little inappropriately for the climate. Many of these fine fellows wear furs over dazzling robes in blue and pink hues. One man at the front of the pack, clearly their leader, has a long cloak fringed with ermine. He approaches Harald and gives a faint bow.
Enrico Capello, ambassador to Romania on behalf of the Lord Doge, Domenico Contarini.
Harald smiles, enjoying the sight of a dandy in his court. He returns to his seat, shifts around, and gives a faint gesture for Enrico to proceed with his petition.
We believe this court's activities to be illegal and counter to the interests of all the Emperor's loyal servants.
Do you speak for the Emperor?
Harald sits up in his throne, leans forward.
I speak for the Empire. The Republic of Venice has long served the interests of Constantinople, but your rogue province here in Sicily threatens Roman interests and Venetian ones. The ransom you demand from all ships across the sea has crippled us. Venetians are starving, because fewer ships arrive every day carrying the goods we need to trade for. And when they do arrive, those goods are well beyond the reach of our citizens.
We do not tax Phoenician ships. If your merchants are gouging you on prices, it is because they are greedy.
With respect, you are wrong, my king. You have made most ports hostile to Venetian ships and Roman ships because of your wanton raiding. If you don't hold it, no trade makes it through, period. And now, the Muslim rulers from Granada to Cairo demand severe bribes to even be seen doing business with us because we are supposed allies of the raiders.
If some ports are hostile, we already have a simple solution. General Phocas would be happy to enforce friendly relations between us and our neighbors. If that's not good enough, you'd best get back on your boat and sail up the Bosphorus.
With a wave of his hand, Harold dismisses Enrico. Enrico collects himself, stands tall and firm for a moment, perhaps expecting Harold to add something else. But not a word slips past Harold's lips. Enrico leads his entourage out in silence.
I'm getting hungry, so if there's anything else, be quick about it.
General Phocas, a bearded and grizzled old Roman, rises and approaches the throne. He salutes Harold and then turns toward the crowd.
We have received word that Robert Guiscard's knights are riding for Bari, following our victory over them at Naples. We are sending a small fleet, and we expect to crush what remains of Robert's army without much resistance. That's what I like to hear. Now, everyone get out. That's enough for today.
Harold rises and exits the room in the company of several Varangians and his attendant. The rest of the room empties out over the course of the next few minutes, while you and Mustafa remain seated in silence. Mustafa smiles, crosses his arms, and leans in toward you. Go ahead, ask me. The fleet is something to behold. You watch from the deck of Harold's titanic ship as hundreds of oars rise and plunge themselves back into the water in unison. A drummer helps to keep the rhythm on each ship, and with the dozens of ships stretching out in every direction, the drummer's chorus sounds more like thunder. The Mediterranean is quiet, for now. The waves are gentle, and a light wind fills the sails, driving the fleet further ahead. You haven't lost sight of the Italian coastline since the fleet passed Reggio. Harold's making no secret of his arrival. At times, the ships come close enough to the coast to see fishermen and the terrified residents of enemy ports. But onward the flotilla goes. Your target is further up the coastline. On the deck of each ship, Varangians, Arabs, and Romans pace around, checking their equipment and making conversation. You see the army is well equipped to fight a partially amphibious battle. There's no heavy armor here. Even chainmail is kept to a bare minimum, for any significant weight could become an anchor, dragging a man to his watery grave should he fall overboard. Instead, leather and only token plates of armor on the shoulders and shins are permitted. The Varangians do allow themselves one heavy indulgence, however. They keep their signature battle axes handy, spoiling for a fight. You notice a few Roman soldiers tending to long siphons on the main ship, handling them with great care. You can't help but turn to Mustafa, seeking answers. And it's like he can read your mind.
Greek fire. Used to be a big surprise, but now everybody has it. Someone let the recipe slip. Still, making it in large quantities is another matter, so we usually bring more heat than our enemies.
Harold's ears perk up, and he joins you and Mustafa. You make a quick bow, hoping it's enough. Harold barely notices.
I can't count how many pirate ships we've reduced to ashes. It's almost a shame that we did our job so well, because now there's rarely any ships out there on these waters, save for our own. We did have a close call with some of the Caliph's ships when we were out sightseeing near Alexandria. But still, nothing to really get the heart going in years. The disappointment on Harold's face is obvious, if a little unsettling. You're not surprised that in your timeline, Harold was still fighting in the year 1066. In fact, he died in that timeline, doing what he seemed to enjoy so thoroughly. May I ask you a question, Harold? Your curiosity gets the better of you. Something's been eating away at you since you first laid eyes on the Viking King. Harold's eyebrows furrow, probably annoyed that you're asking permission to ask a question.
Be straight with me. What do you want to know?
Harold gives you his full attention, fixing his wolf-like eyes on you. What are you hoping to achieve? You have a wonderful situation in Sicily, and the other islands must be really nice to have, but your ambitions on the coasts, you can't really believe they're anything more than that. You can raid a port, maybe hold it for a while, but you can't grow an empire outward from the sea.
Who are you exactly?
Harold looks you over, clearly unimpressed, if a little suspicious. He turns away, returning his gaze to the waters ahead. Mustafa approaches him.
This is a good friend of mine. He is visiting from the capital. I believe he's simply here to satisfy his curiosity and write a few letters about your majesty to his friends back home.
Harold strokes his beard, casts his eyes down. He considers your question. You and Mustafa wait in silence. Harold wanders towards the east side of the deck and looks out at the open sea. Mustafa urges you forward with a gentle nudge.
Are you writing for the Emperor?
Harold's posture solidifies. He grips the rails with his big, meaty hands.
No. It's likely he'll hear about whatever I write, but I don't have to write everything I hear.
Very well. I know I'm never going to sit on the throne in Miklagard. To do that is to have a sword hanging over my head every day, until one day it's not. No, I'll do what my people have always done. Rule the waves. So as long as my navy is strong and my men loyal, no one will ever invade my island home. They can try, but whether their ships come from the mouth of the Nile, the Rhone, or the Bosphorus, it makes no difference.
That's a way to make a lot of enemies. Harold just grins. A loud horn blares, drawing everyone's attention. Mustafa leads Harold towards the bow of the ship. You rush after them, struggling to keep your footing as the ship now rocks under the anxious feet of sailors and soldiers alike. You manage to catch up.
We have reached Bari, Harold.
And Mustafa is right. The port city of Bari stretches out to the west. De Hauteville flags fly high over several buildings, featuring a fierce lion rearing up in rage. The beaches swarm with Norman infantry and mounted knights, all preparing a rough reception for Harold's fleet. Phocas rushes up to Harold and grabs him, turning the king's attention to something further north. You turn to look as well, and the sight puts your heart in knots. Dozens of galleys are riding towards Harold's fleet, all ferrying large contingents of Norman infantry and archers. At a glance, these ships outnumber Harold's fleet 3-1.
Traitors!
Harold smashes his hand on the railing. He turns to his men and shouts his orders.
Ready the Greek fire!
Men get to it, heaving the massive siphons forward to meet the oncoming ships. You hear the faint sound of pumps under the deck. Roman soldiers take up their positions, angle the siphons, and await the king's orders. In that moment,
you wish you were the winged lion now staring you down from the enemy's sails. What you would give to grow wings and fly away from here. Because whatever is about to happen, it's going to be anything but serene. Harold raises his hand, and then brings it back down hard.
Set the sea ablaze!
And with that, the siphons roar to life, spewing long tongues of fire, creating a raging inferno between you and the incoming Venetian ships. Once again, you are consumed by heat, and the sun is once more your oppressor. Your balance gives way, and you struggle to keep yourself from going overboard. You begin to feel yourself slipping away. Will you stay and face the flames, or will you return to your own time? Now is the moment to decide.
That's a very good question. Did you enjoy Kevin's show? Do you want to hear more? I know for myself, I'd love to keep this story going. Kevin has talent, and he will make a great addition to the team. To keep him on, we will need some more members. I'm going to be putting a lot more focus on the members area. I have a members series called Blue Dragons that's in production right now. I'll play you the intro. Even if you don't plan to become a member, this sample is loaded with backstory about the Twilight Histories, so it's worth a listen. Here's your orientation from Blue Dragons. Enjoy. I'm glad to see you're back. That was quite the extended vacation you had. Don't worry, we understand. You've been hitting the pad hard and run up a lot of splits. A lot of splits. You deserve a break. Rumor has it you spent your vacation out in Texas? Red Star Transport, was it? Listen, we have a rule here, and it's in your contract. You work for us now. You can't have any contact with our competition. I know what you're thinking. There's more money if you go over to one of the big companies like Red Star. The Twilight Histories is just a little startup. We rely on tourists and academics, while the big guys like Red Star get huge government contracts and supply and build colonies on other planets. Now, I know you're thinking it. I'm not going to try to sell you on the adventures of splitting worlds, or that it's better to live your passion than to make money. We both know that's garbage. But I will tell you something you might not know. Things are changing. Fast. Red Star jumped space, and we're world splitters. It may seem like a completely different business, but it won't be for long. World splitting is a disruptive technology. It's an existential threat to Red Star's entire business model, and in fact, the entire colonial network. This can't get out, but we have reason to believe that Red Star and the Transport Alliance was behind our little terrorist attack back when you were on Gliese. Yeah, sure, it was terrorists, but why us? They didn't have a reason to bomb us. Red Star and their buddies did. Connect the dots. Ever wonder why we send drones to so many worlds before picking one and sending in an agent? Do you see how small our particle accelerator is compared to Red Star's? Did you ever wonder why we can work with such a scrappy power supply? It takes a lot more energy to bend space than it does to puncture a hole through it. I mean, a lot more. It's about 100 times more expensive for Red Star to send you to Alpha Centauri than it is for Twilight Histories to simply puncture a hole to a different version of Earth. Now think about that. We can do 100 splits with the same amount of energy as it takes Red Star to get to the nearest extrasolar colony. And that's just the nearest. They sometimes send scientific probes out to the far ends of the galaxy, and that requires 100,000 or even 1,000,000 times more energy than it takes to do a split. Any split. They're all the same. One split isn't more energy intensive than any other. Doesn't matter how exotic the world is we send you to. It's the same amount of energy. Why is that disruptive? Why does that threaten Red Star Transport and, well, the Transport Alliance? Why would this threaten the entire colonial network? Think about it. Let's say you are a mining company. That's most of Red Star's customers, miners. What's more cost-effective, mining some distant space rock where you need life support? Or split worlds and mine a pristine version of the Earth, oxygen included? And hey, they don't even need to explore. They already know where the big resources are. They could mine the same exact gold vein 1,000 times, 100,000 times, on different versions of Earth. And they could even mine them all at the same time, no permit required. It's absolutely unlimited. The only limit is labor. There's plenty of that in other worlds. Imagine taking all the builders of the pyramids in some other world and putting them to work digging up gold. Think of the money. Well, that's what the mining companies are thinking about. They don't care where the gold is. All they care about is how much it costs to mine. And what we offer is cheap. You can bet Red Star is shaking in their boots. And why can't any of the big guys beat us at our own game and split worlds, you ask? It's simple. It would destroy them. They'd go bankrupt. Think of all that infrastructure they've invested in. They built the entire colonial network. It spans thousands of planets. It took them 200 years to build the whole thing. You think they can just turn it off? Now, I shouldn't be telling you this, but we want you to stay here. You've done a lot of splits. You did a great job on your trial run. We want you. But we're worried you're going to be drawn into the better pay over at Red Star. That's why I'm telling you, if you stay here at the Twilight Histories, you're going to be part of something really special. This is the leading edge, right here. This is the next big leap forward. We've already got a mining company interested. We're putting our feelers out for more. I'm telling you, things are about to really heat up at the Twilight Histories, and the money is coming. Once we start getting miners and building colonies, we're going to need people like you more than ever. And there will be a lot more money for you, I promise. Does that all make sense? At any rate, we should probably get on with your orientation. We have a special assignment for you today. As you probably know, the Colonial Network has been talking a lot about terraforming Venus lately. Venus is close, so it's less expensive to get to, right? There are a lot of resources on Venus. It would be a good world to colonize, if it were terraformed. Foolish, but hey, it's their money. What you might not know is that the Colonial Network is looking for vendors. They actually want to do this crazy scheme. One of these vendors has come to us. They're putting together a presentation for the Colonial Network. To get an edge over the competition, they had the brilliant idea of splitting worlds, finding a civilization that's already terraformed Venus, and then build their presentation around that. Terraforming Venus will probably be extremely expensive, and it will take an extremely long time. Our client tells us it could take 500 years just to cool the planet down enough so that metals don't melt on the surface. If that gives you an idea, add another 500 years to get the oxygen levels just right, and another 500 years to get the planet lush and green. The whole project seems mad to us, of course. Why not just split to another version of Earth? But hey, what do we know? The client needs evidence. They want to see the results. They want to show the Colonial Network all the challenges and offer them a solution that's proven to work. And because this project is so high profile, they're willing to pay top dollar for this split. You may be wondering why we've put you on this assignment and not one of our more experienced agents. The truth is, this job is time sensitive and our agents are on missions. You did a great job in your Black Scourge world, and we're going to move you along into some higher profile work. You're going to get paid more for this one, too. Before we bring in the client, let me give you a quick rundown of the mission. we sent drones out to a number of prospective worlds. Instead of pointing the cameras down, we pointed them up. As in, up towards space. The cameras weren't powerful enough to capture good images of Venus's surface, but through some analysis, we were able to tell something about the atmospheres of the different worlds. Here, take a look at these images. These six are from missions that come back negative. That yellow dot is Venus. Now, look at this one. See how it looks bluish-green? It's kind of like Earth, right? Our client tells us that's evidence of terraforming. So we believe we have the right world. The problem will be getting you to Venus. We can get you to Earth easily enough. We just punch you through. But with this ancient Swiss accelerator, we simply don't have the payload to get you off-planet. We can't bend space. We could do it from our Chinese accelerator in Urumqi, but not from this one. So we're going to punch you through to Earth, and then you're going to have to get your client to Venus somehow. And back. How? We assumed that Venus is terraformed. There must be an advanced civilization that did the terraforming. They should have a way of traveling between the planets. Money? Clothes? We don't have the intel. We don't know anything about this world except that Venus looks terraformed. We've given you a basic survival kit, standard issue military grade. Your pack is over there. Ah, and here's our client, April Reinhardt. It's so nice to see you. I'd like to introduce you to your agent. And let me put your fears at ease. You are in very capable hands. This is one of our top agents with extensive experience in this type of work. Well, it sounds like the accelerator is powered up and ready to go. Now, please, Miss Reinhardt, step on the platform, both of you please, and we'll get you on your way. Miss Reinhardt, you're going to feel a bit dizzy, and you might not remember where you are at first. Don't worry, your agent will guide you through this. Very soon, you'll be on Venus. Terraformed Venus. That was the intro for Blue Dragons, a multi-part series available only to members. If you want to join us on this journey and help us hire Kevin Valbonesi, you can sign up by visiting the website at twilighthistories.com and clicking on the page called Members. I recommend using the Patreon page. Again, visit twilighthistories.com and click on Members. I'm Jordan Harbour. Until next time, take care.